they had been setting records with their profits year after year. Last year was somewhat of an anomaly just because of the size of their profits. But over the last many years, every year has been a record-breaking year for most insurers, even since the Affordable Care Act was passed, which we were led to believe that the affordable in that name would lead to more affordable healthcare costs. It really has not. When you see especially how insurance companies have been able to profit.
That's Wendell Potter, former insurance company executive and author of Deadly Spin. An insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. And this is Healthcare Confidential. I'm your host, Teresa Jacob Ellis, talking with innovators and experts about health and healthcare in America. I couldn't be more pleased than I am today to welcome Wendell Potter to the show. Wendell spent more than two decades working in the health insurance industry as a top public relations executive. He left the industry after what he describes as a crisis of conscience in 2008. Since then, he has written three books and numerous articles and commentaries. More recently, he returned to journalism where he began his career. Wendell Potter, it's an honor to have you on Healthcare Confidential. Thanks for being here.
Oh, Teresa, thank you for this opportunity.
After working in your early career as a reporter, you were enticed into PR. What was that transition like for you? And what were your years in the health insurance industry focused on?
You know, my first job outside of journalism was in the political field. I was enticed into serving as a press secretary for someone who was running for governor of Tennessee. And he won the primary, lost the general election, and that was the end of that, but the beginning really of my public relations career. And I went on ultimately to work in a hospital in East Tennessee where I grew up, was head of public relations and advertising for what was then called the Baptist Health System of East Tennessee. And I was recruited from there to go to Humana. Humana at that time owned a lot of hospitals. In fact, I think it might've been at that time the largest operator of hospitals, certainly the for-profit hospitals in the country, and with the head of hospitals abroad as well too. And I was there for 4 years. And during that time, the company transitioned to just be a pure managed care company. They sold out their hospitals. And around that time, I was recruited to Cigna, and I was at Cigna for about 15 years, altogether about 20 years in two of the largest for-profit health insurance companies. And I, as you said, I left after a crisis of conscience. I first was bought in fully on the concept of private companies being able to help fix the problems with their healthcare system. Didn't really understand the distinction between nonprofit and for-profit healthcare or health insurance, but I, over the years, got an awakening and a realization of exactly what motivates the top executives of these big companies, and that is to make a lot of money. That's the number one priority.
I want to talk about that, but I read your book when it first came out, and I still recall in vivid detail the situation that you described. It stayed with me ever since I first read it. Can you tell our listeners that that experience that you had with a free clinic that you observed?
Well, I was writing a white paper for the industry, trying to downplay the importance of the uninsured as an issue that the public should be concerned about. I took a few days off and flew back down to Tennessee to visit family. And while I was there, I just picked up a newspaper and read about this, something that was being called a healthcare expedition at a county fairground near where I grew up. And I went there out of curiosity. And when I got there, I was just absolutely dumbstruck. I couldn't believe what I was witnessing. When I went through the fairground gates, I saw people who were lined up by the hundreds. In many different lines, they were soaking wet because it had been raining that morning. And I noticed that a lot of those lines led to animal stalls on the fairground site. You know, this is where county fairgrounds were held, county fairs were held. And It just did something to me. It was almost like an electrical jolt or some sudden realization that what I was doing for a living was making it necessary for people that I could have grown up with to get care in that kind of a setting. And I realized it could have been me if I hadn't been lucky, if I hadn't been born to parents who were able to sacrifice and send me to college to, you know, have a very successful career. And I realized I had to find some other way to earn a living. When I saw human beings being treated by doctors and nurses in animal stalls, it was just something I could never have imagined that I would see in this country. And I knew I had to accept some responsibility because my job was to try to persuade Americans that we have the best healthcare system in the world and that private insurance companies are a big part of the solution. And I knew we were not. I knew from the work that I did, and part of the work that I did was handling financial communications. So I know, and I knew then, what motivated the top executives, which is to always meet Wall Street's profit expectations first and foremost.
Right. I mean, health insurance companies are publicly traded, often corporations, and their allegiance is to their shareholders, not to patients. So what are some other misconceptions do you think that people have about health insurance companies? They really don't, a lot of people don't understand that dynamic.
They don't. And they have some misplaced faith that private insurance companies can control healthcare costs and can assure access to quality care. They cannot. Not only can they not control costs, they're indifferent to it. Or maybe even, I think it's not just indifference. They willfully are unconcerned about rising healthcare costs, even though they will talk a good game about their ability to keep healthcare costs in check. They really cannot, nor are they willing to. When I say they cannot, because we have this fragmented system of paying for healthcare, no one insurance company is big enough to really bring down the cost of care in any one hospital setting or facility. They just can't do it. But they're not interested because the more those prices go up, the more they can demand in increases in premiums. They're the only game in town in this country for employers and for most of us who are not eligible for a public plan. So they've got the marketplace locked up. And as those healthcare costs go up, as hospital costs go up, prescription drug cost, physician care, all they do is just anticipate how much more is going to increase next year so that they'll know how much to increase their premiums. It's been going on for decades, but we still do not question the so-called value proposition of these companies.
Right. That's so in very simplistic terms, would the elimination of private health insurance have an impact on costs?
I think it would, because we have the evidence that the public program called Medicare can do that. It's been around now for more than half a century. And the way that Medicare does this is determines a specific cost for a specific procedure or a good and service. And private insurers pay significantly more than the Medicare program does, certainly more than the Medicaid program pays. So they're not efficient. And one problem is because, again, this multiplicity of private insurers, this fragmented system that we have, the administrative costs are far, far higher than they are in any other country in the world. Now, there are other rich countries that have private insurance companies that do operate, but they're much more heavily regulated, and they all essentially pay the same amount for healthcare. They don't rely on or give the insurers the responsibility of individually negotiating rates with providers. So I guess my answer to that briefly is that you can have a system that has private insurers operating, but they can't control the healthcare system like we've allowed them to do. They have to be significantly regulated, and there has to be some entity that determines how much a healthcare good and service should cost and how much we should be paying for it.
So just to play devil's advocate here, so on the provider side, the hospitals would say that the private insurance has to pay more because they're subsidizing the money that they're losing on Medicare payments and Medicaid payments for services. Do you feel that there's validity there?
There's validity only to the point that those providers are probably not operating as efficiently as they could and should. And they have an incentive to increase their own profits. And the insurance companies are right there enabling them to do that. But the reality is that there are a lot of hospitals that survive with primarily Medicare reimbursement and Medicaid reimbursement. So it is possible to provide good quality care and access to that care without relying on the extra payments that insurance companies pay. And when I say, you know, that's connected to what I was saying before, these private insurers have no alternative but to pay that additional amount because the providers are able to, in a sense, demand that extra amount because these insurers are not quite as influential or able to bargain as successfully as they would like us to believe. And again, as I said earlier, they don't have that incentive. I would add, though, that I think that if we were to move to a Medicare for all type of healthcare system, which I have advocated for, because I think it is better than the system that we have now. It's not the only way to get to where we need to be, but you could look at raising the Medicare reimbursement to a level to compensate for the lack of this additional money from private insurers. So it can be done. You don't have to have these private insurers, as many companies have demonstrated over many years.
I mean, in reality, Medicare today is paying for, theoretically, our most expensive consumers of healthcare.
That's right. You've got the oldest, and in many cases, the sickest patients. So the administrative costs within Medicare is significantly lower, a lot lower than what you see on the private side.
Right. So if you start adding into that pool of insured or covered lives, younger, healthier people,
yeah,
essentially costs may even go down.
I think they would go down. And the other thing that you would realize would be significant savings in administration. It's been shown that we spend about $4 trillion a year in this country on healthcare. And about 30% to a third of that goes to overhead, goes to administrative functions that are unique to our system because of our fragmented way of paying for care. Extraordinarily inefficient. Not only do you have these big insurance companies with thousands of employees, their very existence makes it necessary for hospitals and physician practices to have people on staff who do nothing more day in and day out, but dealing with these individual insurance companies and their multiplicity of health plans. So it's extraordinarily inefficient and costly,
yeah,
unnecessarily.
Makes a lot of sense. Can you talk about how the insurance industry continues to exert control over the debate around healthcare financing in America? So what are some of the tactics that they use to shape public opinion and to influence legislation?
Their tactics are part of a broad strategy that they've implemented very successfully over a long period of time. Much of it was the work that I used to do. And I'm not going to be equivocal here. It's propaganda. It's corporate propaganda. A lot of what you hear out of the industry, whether it's from them directly or from their allies, is misleading. It is not true. It's like what I was saying. I was writing this white paper, for example, to try to make people think that the people who were uninsured in this country were that way by choice. So they know how to manipulate public opinion. They spend an enormous amount of the money that we pay them to provide us access to care. They use a significant amount of the money that we pay on propaganda campaigns. They spend a lot of money researching what messages work best and how best to get those messages into our heads and into the heads of policymakers. So that's one thing. They're very adept at getting us to believe things that just simply are not true or that are just half true. The other is they spend a lot of money on campaign contributions. locking in support from members of Congress that they support and legislators, and they spend huge sums of money on lobbying. And advocates for reform have not ever been able to come up with anywhere close to the same amount of money that the industry uses to wage these propaganda campaigns and these lobbying campaigns. So they take our money to do this, to what, you know, ultimately make it an absolute certainty that a lot of us are not going to get the care that we need or the care that we can afford.
So some of these common talking points that we all hear all the time, are these sort of from the industry, things like the Canadian system is inefficient and people wait forever to get their care? The federal government can't get anything right. What makes us think they could possibly manage the healthcare system for everyone?
That's exactly right. A big part of the effort when I was in the industry was to really be extraordinarily critical and misleading about the Canadian system in particular, because it's just, you know, on our northern border. And it's worked extraordinarily well for Canadians. I've spent a lot of time there. They are absolutely baffled that we put up with the system that we do and that we believe the things that we do about their system. But when you can spend decades of misleading people about something, it sinks in and people believe things that just simply are not true. And part of the reason for that is that we don't have any personal experience or knowledge. We don't know a lot of Canadians or spend time up there. So we're more likely to be gullible and misled, and they are able to get people that we trust to say things that are not true. And sometimes those people are carrying water for the industry unwittingly, sometimes on purpose, because they're paid to do it. So that's exactly right. That's one thing in particular. We wanted people, and the industry still does, want people to think that any system that's not like ours is socialism, and we certainly don't want to have anything like socialism, even though most of the systems in the developed world are not socialistic systems, but we wanted people to believe that. So that's basically it. It's not more complicated than that. They are able to persuade us and the people we vote for and our employers that they're essential and vital, and that they have a value proposition that is worth retaining.
What I found really interesting also was the analogy that I've heard you use about how it would look in this country if our fire departments were financed the way our healthcare system is. Can you share that analogy with our listeners?
Right. There are certain things that we take for granted that are really part of the common good, that we pay taxes, and that we would really, I think, revolt if we were told, well, we're not going to do that anymore. We're just going to let private companies get in the business of protecting us if our house is on fire. In fact, that was at the early years of our republic, what it was like. I'm here in Philadelphia, and Ben Franklin and some of his cronies back in the day, they provided fire protection. And you can walk in around my neighborhood and you can see plaques on some of the buildings. And those were plaques for people who had bought some private fire insurance. The next door neighbor might not have. So if that neighbor's house caught fire, it wouldn't do you much good, even though you were paying your premiums for your fire protection. So it just does not work. And we also wanted to vilify the government broadly. And that was a big part of the campaign. And it's not just insurers, but big industries, big corporations broadly wanted us to believe that the government was spending money unnecessarily, they were very inefficient. We would sometimes say, and you may still hear from time to time, why would you want a government that operates a DMV to run your health insurance? Because everyone knows that you can find getting your driver's license to be somewhat of a hassle, but they're entirely different things. What we're talking about here is just reorganizing the way that we pay for care, not how it's delivered. And the Canadian system is like that. It's a system where you have privately delivered care, and exceptionally good care, but it's more equally available to everybody in that country. In fact, they have universal coverage, far more, you know, we're not even close to it these days.
Yeah, and the pandemic really, I think, highlighted for us the problem that you run into when you tie healthcare coverage to employment, right? When so many people began losing their jobs early on in the pandemic.
That's absolutely right. And that, by the way, is another tactic of the insurance industry to make us think that the employer-based system is sacred, that it is something that we have to protect at all costs. But you're exactly right. We saw during the pandemic, just millions of people who lost not only their jobs, but their health insurance. And I think a lot of people woke up to realize this doesn't make a lot of sense. Why is my access to care tied to whether or not I have a job and working for an employer that offers benefits? And here's the thing. We heard a lot of political candidates, Democrats, saying during this last election cycle that 150 million Americans get their coverage through the workplace. That's true. But you could have said and used that exact same number 20 years ago. But the population of the United States has increased about 50 million over that period of time. The point I'm making is here, that has remained stable as a number while you've had a significant increase in population. And one thing they don't tell you is that increasingly small employers are thrown in the towel. They cannot do this anymore. More than half of small employers with 50 employees or less don't offer benefits because they can't. It's too expensive. It's only the largest employers and significantly, you know, employers of, you know, mid-sized employers that are able to stay in that game. So it's a system that has been crumbling for a long time. And during the pandemic, we saw it nearly collapse.
We also saw that health insurance companies profited during the pandemic while providers were hurt. They suffered financially during the pandemic. How did that dynamic play out?
Well, in fact, in 2020 was the most profitable year in the history of most of these companies. And that is despite their losing quite a lot of customers because their customers lost their jobs. They were continuing to take in premiums, though, but they were not paying for a lot of care. Yes, we had a lot of people clearly who were hospitalized because of COVID, but a lot of people canceled their either voluntarily or involuntarily any elective procedures. They were canceled, so insurers paid out far less in claims than they typically would. So that's how they were able to profiteer so much last year. But keep in mind, they had been setting records with their profits year after year. Last year was somewhat of an anomaly just because of the size of their profits. But over the last many years, every year has been a record-breaking year for most insurers, even since the Affordable Care Act was passed, which we were led to believe that the affordable in that name would lead to more affordable healthcare costs. It really has not. When you see especially how insurance companies have been able to profit over those years.
I did want to ask you about the Affordable Care Act. You have said that you felt it didn't go far enough.
Yeah.
How did it not live up to its promise? Where are the flaws in that system? And do you think that there is any chance of redeeming it and making it stronger and reforming the system that way rather than through Medicare for All?
I think it is possible to make it a lot better and going, but it would need to go beyond what we hear most politicians talk about. It needs to constrain the business practices of insurers in particular more than they have, more than the law has. It does quite a bit of good. It prohibits insurance companies from engaging in, I think, probably one of the most egregious practices, and that was to blackball people because of pre-existing conditions and refusing to sell them coverage at any price. That was one of the reasons, and one of the big reasons why when that bill was passed and became law, we had almost 50 million Americans who didn't have insurance. So it has done some good to bring that number down because insurers can no longer exclude people from coverage. But it enabled insurers to make up the difference, if you will, from what they would have lost in profits by allowing them to shift more and more of the cost of care to us in the form of high deductibles. The Affordable Care Act allows insurance companies to shift as much as over $17,000 to a family to pay out of their own pockets before their coverage kicks in. It's over $8,000 for an individual. That's outrageous. And even those who were involved in putting that bill together acknowledge that that was a mistake, a huge mistake. So that's one thing. And that's one of the things I'm going to be doing going forward. In fact, I am launching a coalition comprising a lot of nonprofit organizations to bring awareness of that outrageous reality that people are spending so much money out of their own pockets for care that many of them are going broke, losing their homes. And a lot of people, to avoid that, are just not getting the care that they need because they know how much they'll have to pay out of their own pockets. It's extraordinarily broken. And that's one of the things that has to be addressed. And the other thing that I did advocate for was making sure that they spend a specific percentage of what we pay in premiums on our health care. But the unintended consequence of that is to just kind of put on steroids their practice of just increasing premiums, because the more healthcare costs go up, they can increase premiums, and that enables them to stay within the parameters of the medical loss ratio provision in that bill. So there are a number of things that can and should be fixed.
I wonder if the ACA has enabled sort of the states to take on more of this burden through the Medicaid program and making healthcare more affordable and accessible where the federal government isn't.
The law did broaden the Medicaid program. And so there are a lot more people enrolled in that. And in fact, I think there, between Medicare and Medicaid, we have about 150 million Americans who are enrolled in one or the other, and sometimes both of those public programs. A lot of states, you know, about 14 states still have not expanded the Medicaid program. So you have a lot of people in those states who remain uninsured because of the cost of coverage. And so states are beginning, though, to experiment and to go beyond where they had been and what's been common practice. Two states this year enacted legislation to create a state-based public option. They differ in certain important ways, but the whole intent was to do something at the state level that's not been able to be done at the federal level, which is to provide people in those states with another option, with a public option. And in my view, that was one of the biggest problems with the Affordable Care Act. The insurance industry was able to get its friends in Congress to strip out the provision that would have created a federal public option. And that's another thing that needs to be revisited and accomplished. And, you know, President Biden has campaigned on that. He hasn't talked about it in a long time. I don't think we're going to see that happening this year, certainly. But it's something that we need to keep the pressure on our elected officials to come back to and really create, as we referred to it back then, a robust public option that would be available to everybody.
So tell us a little bit more. You alluded to your latest project and how you're bringing together nonprofit organizations, because I do want to leave on a kind of an optimistic note and tell people what they can do to kind of get involved in this movement.
Yeah, well, thank you. And it's extraordinarily important, because we know that policymakers know that premiums are going up, and that's where their focus has been. They've given short shrift to what's happening at the other end with these high deductibles. So organizations like Families USA, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the American College of Emergency Physicians, Small Business Majority, my organization, the Center for Health and Democracy, Mended Hearts, there are a lot of groups that represent patients with chronic conditions who are part of this coalition. There are social justice organizations, because a lot of people who are in these high deductible plans are people of color who are especially disadvantaged because they don't have the ability to get the care that they need. And at Boston University. Researchers last year found that women of color who were in high deductible plans were far less likely to be screened for cancer and to be treated for cancer in a timely way. So this is a big issue that a lot of organizations are coming to realize is not good for Americans. So we're launching that. It's going to be an educational campaign, but we're going to be pressing lawmakers and making sure that they begin to pay attention to this and to come up with some solutions. We can't keep doing this. And I'm encouraged that all of these organizations are willing to join us and support us and help making sure this is a real thing. I talked to a woman from my home state of Tennessee just this week, and she was a woman who developed epilepsy. And she just in February suffered, I think, 20 seizures, almost died, had to be hospitalized, had a heart attack. She has a high deductible plan, and she and her husband had to file for bankruptcy. They were looking to buy a house, but that clearly is not a possibility. That's what's happening to Americans who have these chronic conditions that you never can anticipate. And part of the work of this coalition will be to educate Americans. This is what's going on. This could happen to you. And it's happening to a lot of our neighbors day in and day out.
And it sounds like the movement is fortunate to have you involved because you are able to understand and use the same tactics and strategies that the health insurance industry has been using for decades.
I think that if there's one thing that I bring to reform, it is it's a knowledge and understanding of the tactics that they use. And part of the work that we're going to be doing is to use that knowledge and use similar tactics, not the tactics of misleading people, but to help people understand, here's how you're being lied to. Here's what they're doing. Here's the truth. So that's what I'm committed to doing for the rest of my life, as long as I can, because I feel like I need to make amends for what I used to do for a living.
I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us here on Healthcare Confidential. Our guest is Wendell Potter. And can you give us the website or tell us, our listeners, how they can learn more and get involved?
Yes. Look me up. Follow me on Twitter at Wendell Potter. You can check my website, which is wendellpotter.com. And look for the work that we're doing at centerforhealthanddemocracy.org. That's the lead organization. I lead that. It's the lead organization for this coalition. So check us out.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I want to remind listeners that new Healthcare Confidential episodes are available every Monday morning, wherever you access podcasts. The show is brought to you by Prescriptive Studios and hosted on Omni Studio. Our theme song is an original composition written and performed by Patrick Karsik. Our production assistant is John Roy. Views expressed on the show are solely those of the host and guest and do not reflect on any other entity. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us your feedback and help us continue the conversation by dropping a note on the Healthcare Confidential Facebook page. Stay well, everyone.